This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 24 was recorded a day early this week on Wednesday, July 27th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. This week's feature interview topic will be angel investing, which means providing seed money to help launch new startup companies. The risks and rewards involved are both much higher than most conventional investments, so angel investing is restricted by law in the United States to accredited investors. Our guest will be David S. Rose, a serial entrepreneur and one of the most experienced angel investors in the world. David literally wrote the book on angel investing. We'll discuss what kind of investor is well suited to angel investing, what's involved, what the typical angel deal structure looks like, and how to learn more about the subject.
And I'm Aaron Chen. The Federal Reserve Open Market Committee took no action today, deciding not to hike short-term interest rates despite a long streak of economic data beating expectations in recent weeks and equity markets testing new all-time highs. Eric, what's your take on the FOMC meeting?
Well, the press conference is still underway as we're typing, and we have not had the benefit of listening to it. But just looking at the tape action, 10-year yield is still deteriorating. It was 153 before the meeting. It went down to 151. I think it's now about 152. The only data point that I see that justifies this no action outcome is that, because there, as you said, there's been plenty of economic data beats and so forth. It'll be very interesting to see what happens to the 10-year yield from here. You know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. It was down to 1.37, which was a new series low, was bouncing up. Was that just a dead cat bounce that was going to roll over? Well, it's certainly starting to look that way. And of course, no hike from the Fed paves the way for potentially the longer term interest rates to continue to roll over.
Right, and equity markets continue to flirt with new all-time highs, with E-mini S&P futures trading north of 2172 in the overnight futures session between Sunday evening and Monday morning. To accommodate summer travel schedules, we're taping this week's show a day early on Wednesday afternoon, when E-minis were trading around 2162. Eric, what's your take on equities here?
Well, not really much of a change from last week. It's all about, I think, the U.S. being the cleanest shirt in a very, very dirty laundry pile. I was actually was doing a thought experiment you and I talked about off the air last week. What if the Grant Williams scenario is right? In other words, what if the Brexit was just the beginning, the catalyst, and we see eventually a number of additional referenda around Europe? Nigel Farage, incidentally, has actually begun a tour around Europe of campaigning for other countries to follow in his footsteps and, you know, have referenda to exit the European Union. What if the European Union totally crumbles and falls apart in a colossal, massive, horrible event? Is that bullish or bearish for U.S. equities? I think it could actually be bullish. Of course, it would be bearish in the very short term. That would be, you know, such an economic disaster for the whole world. But where is all of the flight capital going to go if not into U.S. treasuries and U.S. equities? So I wouldn't be surprised if things continue to deteriorate around the world if it doesn't just boost U.S. equity prices and further depress U.S. treasury yields.
Yeah, not at all. When we taped the show last week, WTI crude oil was trading around $45 after having tested 46 earlier in the day. But you predicted that it would soon take out key support just above $44, and you went on to predict that the sell-off could accelerate at that point. You know, that's exactly what happened, with WTI testing as low as 42.36 on Tuesday morning, and then subsequently plunging to a 41 handle after Wednesday's inventory numbers came out. You know, you said it would be a short ride down to $40 once 44 had been taken out, and less than a week later, well, we're more than halfway there. So what's your outlook for crude from here?
Well, remember, this is the time of year when we're supposed to be seeing big drawdowns in crude oil inventories because it's the middle of summer driving season. And the idea is that those drawdowns will make room in the storage tanks for the builds that are certain to come as we approach fall maintenance season, when the refineries shut down and we have to have a place to store that crude oil. What size of a drawdown do we get this week? We didn't get any drawdown at all. 1.7 million barrel build on national crude oil inventories. coming in the middle of what should be actually the highest demand season of the year. The very critical Cushing, Oklahoma storage facility, what size drawdown there? No drawdown at all. 1.1 million barrel build. That's the second week in a row of builds on Cushing, Oklahoma inventory at a time of year when we should be seeing big drawdowns. Gasoline has been the big story for the last several weeks, with all of those builds in gasoline inventories at a time when we should be seeing drawdowns. Another almost 500,000 barrels this week, 452,000 barrels of builds in gasoline inventories. We did see a 780,000 barrel drawdown in distillate inventories. That's diesel fuel and jet fuel and that kind of stuff. But again, we had a 4 million barrel build just a couple of weeks ago. So we're seeing small drawdowns in the all-important gasoline, which is the proxy for the discretionary attitude of the American consumer. The gasoline's piling up. It's not selling. I expect continued weakness. There's a little bit of a pop to the upside out of the FOMC meeting. Took us from 41 handle back up above $42. I don't expect that to last. I do think we're headed back below $40. And I think, as I've said before, that the final low and the strategic buying opportunity for energy-related assets will come this fall, around fall maintenance season. Does that mean we're going to go and retest or even go lower than the $26 per barrel low that we had this spring? I don't know. It's possible. I kind of doubt it at this point, but it is still possible, especially if we continue to see these crazy inventory reports with big builds when there should be big drawdowns. I did speak to Art Berman this week. Since we see that the fall is probably when this will all come to a head, we wanted to get you another interview with Art Berman. We've got him booked for our Labor Day weekend show, so that'll be September 1st, Thursday, the Thursday before Labor Day weekend. We're going to get Art back. While I spoke to Art, I did clear up a little bit of confusion, because Art's last article that we sent you 2 weeks ago in the Research Roundup confused me a little bit, as well as some of our listeners in the listener discussion forums. It seemed like Art had changed his mind and no longer thought that prices were headed much higher. Art clarified for me that he still thinks oil prices are headed to the moon after the current situation of market imbalance clears itself out. He simply thinks that when they go to the moon, it's going to have a crippling effect on the global economy and will probably bring on another recession. That's the reason that he is predicting longer term that we will see a return to low oil prices, but not until we see a big spike much higher first. So I just wanted to clarify that for our listeners.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that interview. Eric, we've been watching a technical consolidation range in gold between around 1308 and 1377. Well, last week you observed that the bounce off of 1310 was very much in line with your expectations, but you thought the bounce might be overdone at 1333, the level it was trading at when we taped last week's show. You also said that you wouldn't be surprised if it rolled over and again tested the 1310 level, and that's exactly what happened, with a low trade so far this week of 1311 on Monday morning. It's bouncing back again, trading at 1336 at one point on Wednesday morning, then it spiked all the way up to 1340 when the FOMC announced that there would be no rate hike. So what's next for this barbarous relic from here?
Well, 1340 is as far as it got on the FOMC announcement. We are taping this particular segment of the show while Janet Yellen's press conference is going on. All of a sudden, just as we've been speaking, it went zooming up to 1349.5. The dollar index took a hit at the same time. So Janet must have said something very dovish in her press conference. I don't know at this point what that was. So as far as gold is concerned, I was favoring the case that it might be ready to roll over and take out that 1308 support level all the way back to 1350 now. I haven't heard what Janet said yet, so it's hard to gauge it, but it sounds like there's some more dovish pressure in the system. I'm waiting to see lower than 1308 or higher than 1377 before I really make a strong call here on gold.
Okay, so what about the U.S. dollar index? Last week, we saw the DXY hit 97.37 on an intraday basis, and this week it got as high as 97.62 intraday, but then eventually rolling over and testing 96 handle again within 24 hours. So what's the outlook for the dollar?
Well, when I put my notes together for this show, I was going to say I'm surprised that even in the face of the FOMC, it held on to a 97 handle, didn't get back below 97, was looking pretty strong there. And I thought that the case might be in for the dollar to rally and break above that resistance level at 97. It's pretty dramatically taken a nosedive while we've been taping. Again, all I can assume is Janet Yellen said something very dovish at the press conference, but it looks to me like we're still in this trading range. We have not broken out decisively higher than that 97 level. It's taking a little bit of a plunge in reaction to something Janet must have said. How long is that going to last? We'll let you know next week.
Great. So thanks for the market update, Eric. In keeping with our goal of bringing you more content that specifically appeals to sophisticated, accredited investors, we're going to deviate from our usual macroeconomic focus this week. Well, guys, don't worry. We'll be back next week with another macrocentric show when Charles Biederman joins us as our featured interview guest. But this week's focus will be entirely on angel investing. Eric's interview with serial entrepreneur, author, and angel investor David S. Rose is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Today's guest comes from a family that's no stranger to entrepreneurship. In fact, David S. Rose is a third-generation entrepreneur. That's an unusual distinction, albeit not a unique one. But David is also a third-generation angel investor, and may be the only person alive who can make that claim. David also literally wrote the book on the subject of angel investing. David, I'd like to start with your personal background and how you got involved with angel investing to start with. When you were still a junior in college, your great uncle Dave invited you to lunch in New York City with a few of his friends. And you knew your uncle Dave to be an immigrant who grew up in poverty on the Lower East Side and only had a ninth grade education. But when you met Uncle Dave for lunch that day, everyone else who showed up at the table were Nobel laureates. So what was going on, and how did that experience help to shape your future, both as an entrepreneur and an investor?
Well, so my Uncle Dave was an entrepreneur. He started a business in 1929, which is still going on. It's the family business, which is in real estate, with his brother, my grandfather. Neither my grandfather nor Dave got out of high school, but they were both, you know, complete autodidacts, self-taught, and they were entrepreneurial. And so one of Dave's best friends was a guy named Vladimir Zvorikin, who, if that name doesn't ring a bell, is the guy who invented television. And so here you had a guy who was intensely curious about technology and developments in new kinds of things, who later in his life founded the Foundation for Medical Technology, who became a supporter and friend of all of these innovators along the way, and who, after having a very successful career in real estate development, which he was engaged in until his he died in his late 80s, you know, he believed in both giving back and in leveraging his resources and his acquaintances to sort of improve the world. It's the concept of tikkun olam, to heal the world. And so he would travel around the world. He was a great traveler. And find interesting technologies in oddball places. You know, bring them back to the U.S., provide seed funding to them. And so that's how he was the guy who, you know, personally funded the development of the portable kidney dialysis unit, with the guy who invented the artificial heart. He personally invented through the wall air conditioning. He funded the hyperbaric operating chambers in the U.S. and vascular stapling. And so he corresponded with Albert Einstein. What happens when you combine an entrepreneur, you know, curiosity, do-gooding, and an investor, is you get one heck of a powerhouse. And that's why I dedicated my first book on angel investing to him.
Let's start by defining what angel investing means. What does the term refer to, and why would accredited investors consider making angel investments as part of their portfolio?
So if you think about where the funding comes from for early stage companies, people typically think of venture capital funds or, you know, how you fund a company, you go to a bank, right? Well, the problem is when you're talking about a very early stage investment, a seed investment, the first money into a company, banks are not in the business of taking risk, or at least they shouldn't be. they're in the business of renting money because they know how it's going to be paid back, and they just take the rent of that money, also known as interest, to compensate for the use of your use of their money. In a startup company, there is no guarantee at all that the company will have a profit, or let alone get any revenues in to pay it back. So banks simply do not lend to startup companies. On the other hand, venture capital funds, whom we think about as the funders of early stage companies, raise large pools of money from their limited partners, typically institutions like pension funds and insurance companies and endowments and so on. And they put that into companies they think will be very high growth, but they're putting big amount of money to work. So a typical venture fund investment might be, you know, $3 million, $5 million, $10 million. And since they're buying minority interest in the company, that implies that the company, when they invest, will be worth 10, 20, or more $1 million, right? And so clearly a startup, you know, when you get going first, is not worth $20 million. So, where do you get the funding from? Well, for these accredited investors who are looking to get a high return and are willing to take some risk and are willing to put some of their time and effort into finding that, you can actually invest in these early stage companies at the very, very earliest stages when they're just starting out. And so that's what an angel investor is. An angel investor is an individual accredited investor who puts money into a startup company at its earliest stages, hopefully provides even more value than just the money, such as advice or connections or introductions and so on, and then goes, you know, that money grows and grows and grows, and with, you know, targeted very, very high returns, at the end of the day, you can make quite a bit of money by investing. It's very risky, but you can make at the end of the day a lot of money by investing in a company when it just is starting up.
And what are the characteristics and traits of a good angel investor? Who is well suited to doing this?
Oh, the answer is not everybody. Because the typical angel investor is taking a lot of risk. If you're investing in a company just when it's, you know, two guys and a cat in the garage, before they've found their product market fit, before they have shown that they can actually make profitable revenues in here, it's very, very risky. And it's very long term, because more so than virtually anything else, angel investments are illiquid. So we all know the public markets are liquid. A hedge fund or a PE fund, you know, might be not very liquid. You may have withdrawals, you know, once a year, or maybe even not to the end of the fund in 5 years or 10 years. In the case of angel investing, there is no money to take you out until the exit, until, you know, this company, which is starting in a garage with no product and no revenue or whatever else, until it ultimately either goes public, which is unusual, or is acquired in an M&A transaction. And so that, in the average time in the U.S. as a holding period, is over 9 years. And so there's no chance of liquidity, you know, before that. So you need, first of all, somebody with a very long-term view. You have to understand money you're putting in is not coming out until the end of the game. Number two, because this is extraordinarily risky, you have to have a strong economic base. That's why it's limited only to accredited investors in the U.S. You know, a majority of all startup companies fail. If half of all companies fail, that means it's not that you may not get a, you know, 20% return. It means you're going to get a 0% return and lose your bait. So therefore, you have to have the cash to fund this in the first place. Next, not only do you need to have the cash that you can lose, you need to have the personal mindset, the psychiatric approach that you can have a tolerance for failure. So often, entrepreneurs have a tolerance for risk, and investors, you know, can take risky bets. But if they lose, they get all upset. So this is not necessarily for type A personalities who will be really pissed at themselves or the world if you lose your money, because the odds are that in any given angel investment, any one deal, you may likely lose all your money. So you have to have that kind of tolerance in there. And that goes to speaking, if you combine long-term and tolerance for losses and so on, you're talking about a temperament that has to be calm, because bad stuff happens. You're dealing typically a first-time entrepreneur at the earliest stages of their business career, where they have no clue as to how things work, where they're dealing with a new idea in maybe a new marketplace, where they're going to make mistakes and all kinds of stuff's going to happen. And you better have the temperament to be able to deal with that, people skills to be able to take both the good stuff and the bad stuff at the same time, the self-discipline to invest your money over the long term. I know you and I were talking. You've made one angel investment, but that's not the right way to do it. If you're going to be an angel investor, you have to think about portfolio theory, portfolio distribution, and that means setting out day one to invest in a whole bunch of companies. In my book, I suggest close to 30, but I would say at least 20 would be a minimum. And if you can't do at least 10, you shouldn't even start. Because, of those with the odds of, most of them being failures and not successes, you invest in one, the odds are you're going to lose all your money. On the other hand, if you invest in 10 or 20 or 30, and you have a couple of home runs that really turn big dollars, back to you, then the whole portfolio over time works. But you got to be sure you get that one by having the discipline to invest, similar amounts of money with appropriate diligence and everything else into these companies. And then that brings you to the sort of the willingness to understand and learn. Nobody is necessarily born an angel investor. Even great entrepreneurs who've made their money and turn around to look for startups have challenges. There is a science to doing this. That's why I wrote the book, which goes through a whole lot of the issues involved. But whether you're learning from a book or you're learning from other angels with whom you co-invest, be prepared to have a very long learning curve. As Ben Franklin wrote, experience is a hard school, but some will learn through no other. And that's the only way you really learn angel investing. And then finally, you got to have a love for these people in whom you're investing, these entrepreneurs. Angel investing is not a cold-blooded sport. It really is a life game where you are intertwining your life with that of the entrepreneur in whom you're backing. And you have to have respect for the risks that they are taking. There's a wonderful New Yorker cartoon which shows a couple of entrepreneurs pitching and an investor saying, we've put our hearts and soul into this company. All we're asking from you is $10 million. So you may be putting in $10 million, but they literally are putting their hearts and soul in there, and you have to want to be with them for the long haul. So that describes, all taken together, a pretty special kind of person, long-term long-term view, economic ability to take the losses, psychic ability to do, take risks and have losses, temperament, people skills to deal with these guys, respect for the startup entrepreneur who, looks at the world a different way than you do. The self-discipline to do it over a long period of time and a whole portfolio, and a willingness to learn.
Now, I know from experience that some investors, myself included, get involved with angel investing for the wrong reasons and have unrealistic expectations of what it's going to be like. Who is angel investing not suited to? What patterns do you see in terms of people that get involved with it and maybe shouldn't?
If you're in it just for the money, right, you're saying, okay, I can get this in a hedge fund and that in the market and do day trading over here. If it's just economic, it's not worth it. So you have to look at the larger picture. And all the most successful angel investors in my experience have been ones who are financially focused. They understand the economics, but they understand the economics on a large portfolio theory as basis, as we talked about before. And you have to want to do this. There is a reason that although you're an accredited investor, if you're an angel investor, I describe angels as rich-ish people. If you're really, really rich, if you're Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or something, you're not making angel investments, because you simply have too much money to put to work, and you're putting, decamillions into hedge funds or PE funds or whatever. Typical angel investments are much, much smaller than that, and so you have to have somebody who can be willing to spend the time to find and analyze and put the money in on a relatively small investment. So that typically means somebody who is an accredited investor, which means north of $1 million, but is not so wealthy that they, have to be concerned with their big, big numbers, and they have the time available for this. So you're looking for somebody who is motivated because they love entrepreneurs and they want to be part of innovation and so on and so forth. They have, the right amount of capital that they can do this. They have an even temperament. They're not there. They can be prepared to stomach losses. So when your first time your company misses its projections, you don't go all ballistic and blow up at the CEO, which would be toxic. But if you meet those qualifications and you see this as risky, but over time with a portfolio, a viable way to get a decent return, and if you're willing to take a long view and you like the concept of innovation and startups, then it's certainly worth a shot.
What kind of investment returns can be expected from angel investing, and why is it so important to diversify into a large number of different deals?
Well, there have been several studies that have shown that the typical return on a professionally managed long-term angel portfolio, and these are typically surveys that are done on angels who belong to angel groups and so on, is somewhere between 20 to 30%. So figure 25% should be the target return for angel investing, which is, of course, way higher than the public markets or hedge funds or even venture funds. The typical top quartile venture fund will target 20%. And so you can do better than that in theory with angel investing, but at a cost. And the cost is illiquidity, long-term, personal involvement, so on and so forth. But and if you do it right and pay attention and sort of follow the rules and a rational approach to doing this, 25% IRR on an ongoing basis is certainly not out of reach.
And I think it's very important to stress that is all true for people who have the discipline to follow your advice and have that well-balanced portfolio. I remember from my own experience with this, I saw a lot of people coming in with unrealistic expectations, doing two or three deals, losing all of their money, crying over spilt milk and going home and not staying with it.
That is the single biggest problem with angel investing. People hear about it, or they read something about it somewhere. They come in and they maybe go to an angel group or a demo day or an accelerator, pitch day, and they see half a dozen pitches from these cool, innovative startup companies, and they're all shiny, carefully honed pitches that look extremely exciting, and they're carried away, and they write a 25K or 50K or 100K check, and then they sort of expect that this is like investing in the market. So, a month later, you can see your stock's gone up, and if you need cash at the end of the year, you sell it and you go and do something else. Doesn't work that way. First of all, most of these companies, or certainly a large number of them, will fail, which is not going to happen typically in the public markets. Secondly, the time it's going to take for them to succeed, for your money to be worth more, is not measured in days or weeks or even months, but in years, and typically then in multiples of years. And then as we discussed, the liquidity just isn't there, so you're waiting for a decade. And that's a long time to maintain that kind of enthusiasm on the practice. So, you should not be just jumping in and looking at this as another way, I'll invest in an oil company over here. Not the same thing, very, very different.
Newbie entrepreneurs tend to be obsessed with whatever idea they have for the business that they want to form, and they often guard the secrecy of their ideas a little bit too closely. But experienced angel investors know that the viability of the business idea in question is actually far less important than the suitability of the entrepreneur themselves for the job of being entrepreneur. Please explain why angels often say it's far better to bet on the jockey than the horse.
Well, it's actually a combination of all these factors, right? So, what kind of things, if you're investing at the earliest stages of a company, you don't have the track record to point to. You don't have, last year's revenue statement or earnings per share to do it. This is not at all like the public markets. You're betting on a vision and a dream. And that's a combination of a whole bunch of factors. It's a combination of, an idea for a company, an idea that's in a particular market. How's that overall market doing? What's the particular business model for this particular idea or this particular product? Then, how are you going to reach your customers and how are you going to execute? It all ultimately comes down to execution. And so the trick here is, that a mediocre idea with spectacular execution every time is going to outweigh the world's most brilliant idea with mediocre execution. There are a couple of wonderful blog posts. I include one in the book by a really bright guy named Derek Sivers. But the ultimately comes down to the match. And that means, since execution is key, you've got to invest in somebody who can execute. And so that's why we say bet the jockey, not the horse. That's why we say we'll always take an A player with a B business plan over a B player with an A business plan, because he'll screw it up. And it takes a very special entrepreneur to make that, A plan turn into a really big success. And so to put things in perspective, in my day job when I'm not investing, I actually run a company called Gust, G-U-S-T, which is the world's technical infrastructure platform that underlies this whole world of angel investing. We're used by something like close to 1,000 angel investment groups around the world to manage their applications and collaboration. And 500,000 startup companies to reach out to angels and to others to tell about their businesses. So if you figure that today there are something like 500,000 startup companies on Gust with profiles looking for early stage angel investment, then you ask yourself, do we think that there are 500,000 business ideas out there? And the answer is, of course not. There simply aren't. How about 50,000 different business ideas? Well, you know what? Not them either. Okay, how about 5,000 business ideas? Maybe, but you know that may be a little high. How about 500 business ideas? Okay, probably 500 different ideas, right? So what that means is that today there are between 100 and 1,000 people with the same idea looking for funding. So it's not the idea that's the special sauce. It's the idea combined with the person in the market and everything else all comes down to execution.
Walk us through what a typical angel deal looks like. How much money gets raised typically? How much is put up by each angel investor? How many angel investors are involved in the deal? How does this work?
There typically is a funding sequence. So let's look at it from the perspective of the company's life cycle and the entrepreneur, right? So where does the very, very first dollar come from to fund a startup company? It comes from the entrepreneur himself or herself. Because if the entrepreneur is not willing to put cold, hard, fungible cash behind their idea, then you sure as heck shouldn't, right? So we call it having skin in the game. So that's where the typically the average entrepreneur will put in anywhere from, you know, 10,000 to 100,000 bucks order of magnitude to fund their idea. And once they've exhausted their personal cash and maybe taken out some credit card debt or whatever it is, then what's next? Well, typically they're at a very, very early stage. No bank's going to lend to them. VCs aren't going to touch them, certainly not private equity or anything. So the only people who will give them the time of day are their friends and family because they love and know and respect this person, and they're betting on the person. And so typically, a friends and family round is what happens after the original entrepreneur's money coming in. And we don't call this an angel round because it's not arm's length. These are people who are part of the network of the entrepreneur up front, and they're typically doing it because they like the person, not because they're experts in the idea or the market. And so, you know, a friends and family round can be anywhere from, you know, 25 or 50,000 to, you know, a quarter million, a half a million bucks. Most people don't have families that can come up with a half a million bucks. And so that typically gets a company to the point where it's got a product or at least a prototype. It may have some beta customers or even first paying customers over there. And it's at that stage typically that angel investors step in. So the average angel investment per investor per company is about $25,000, and that typically is the minimum for most of the major angel groups in the country. If you're looking at a deal, you'll write a check for $25,000, and then taken together, the size of that round has been, you know, changing and creeping up a little bit over time, but you figure that anywhere from $250,000 to $750,000. Would be a not atypical angel round. You know, these days is it, you know, half a million to a million, maybe, but that's the general area. So you're looking at an individual writing a check for, you know, plus or minus 25K, and the company taking an aggregate in the door of, you know, half a million or more.
Now, describe the life. Let's suppose a person has just written that $25,000 check. This company is going to continue, though, to have a life that involves financing from other people, like venture firms, before it eventually gets to the point where the deal is harvested and the angel gets their money back. So what does this feel like from the angel's perspective? They've written their $25,000 check. What happens next over a period of years before they ever see any money back?
That's a good question. So you can figure that the angel round is the first pro money, or at least semi-pro money, into a company. Around this stage, the company, if it's doing well and is an attractive company, might be looking also at seed funds, or what are known as super angel funds. So these are very, very early stage venture funds, whereas the typical venture fund might be a $200 million or $300 million fund, which invests you know, $5 million or more into companies in the early stage. A seed fund might only be $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 million and will typically be investing at about the same time and amounts as an angel group in the hundreds of thousands of dollars very, very early on. So after the angels are coming in, or maybe even at the same time as part of the same round, you may well find yourself with a seed fund investing in the company. And then if the company, you know, improves, and by the way, you can skip several of these stages if the company is wildly successful, you get a lot of cash. But I'm talking canonically over here. So canonically, if the company has now done it with founders, friends and family, angels, seed fund, and it's really growing and being successful, then they're going to look at venture capital funds. And a venture capital fund, as we discussed, this is a professional fund run by professional money managers, and they're compensated on a 2 and 20, 2% management fee, 20% of the net profits. And so they take money from large endowments and pension funds and the big mega rich folks, and then they put that to work in these early stage companies. And so a company from an early stage venture fund might raise, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million. If the company uses that money to good end and creates real value, they might then raise another round of 5 million, 10 million, 20 million. And then finally, if the company is still private at that point, is doing extremely well and has raised, a lot of cash, you can then go into crazy kinds of, Uber is now raising $1 billion or $2 billion privately at this point. That's an outlier, but there are big money in there. And then eventually, you can take corporate strategic money in possibly. You can go public. You can be acquired by a larger company. So that's sort of the life cycle of the investment into an early stage startup.
Now, although I've only done one angel deal myself, the biggest lesson by far that I learned from the experience was the importance of networking with other more experienced angels. Our mutual friend Bill, who doesn't want his last name publicized, was instrumental in acting as the lead investor in my angel investment, and I can't imagine going it alone without the experience of a veteran angel kind of organizing the deal. So if someone were interested in getting involved with angel investing, what do they do in order to network and meet other experienced angels?
Well, by far the best vehicle for that are these angel groups. So angel groups began, the first ones were founded in the late 1980s. They began to get a little more frequent during the whole first dot-com boom in the late 90s. So by the height of the dot-com boom, there may have been a couple of dozen groups around the country. And then, unfortunately, when the dot-com crash came, since these were all early stage stuff, everybody lost their shirts in that, and a lot of these groups dissolved. Then after the rise of the world following the dot-com crash, when VCs were out of the market because their LPs were absolutely horrified about having lost all that cash in the dot-com boom. So VCs were sitting on big funds but weren't investing, and it was a great time to be an angel investor. So if you were willing to write a check as an individual, you could have your choice of deals. And so a lot of these people at that point who found themselves in similar deals began to get together to self-aggregate into these groups to share deal flow, to share, compile their funds into a larger check size, to share diligence and the like. And those early angel groups, New York Angels, my group that I founded, was founded in 2003-2004. Those groups had some great track records, and people began to learn by doing. And so an angel group, of which today there are close to 1,000 in the world, an angel group is a wonderful place to find other angel investors, many of whom will be more sophisticated or experienced than you are, and to learn from them. And one of the core goals of an angel group is to train angel investors. And whether it's by having education sessions or deal teams that pair experienced investors with newbies, whether they have in New York Angels, for example, has a standard set of documents for which I wrote a full annotation. So there's a term sheet with everything annotated so you can see exactly what exists and why it exists. So an angel group is a great first step after reading my book, which is the instruction book, is a great first step to find other angels and begin to see deal flow and begin to hear how other people think about a particular idea.
Now, I was extremely impressed with your group, New York Angels. That's where I met our mutual friend, Bill. That's where I learned about the one company that I did invest in as an angel investor. But frankly, after leaving New York, I explored some other angel groups, one down in Florida that turned out to be a dinner club for high net worth investors or high net worth individuals, frankly. I don't think anybody was really interested in investing. And basically, it was a guy who was really running what was effectively his own unlicensed fund where he was doing the investing, and he was inviting people to dinner to listen to entrepreneurs, but none of them knew anything about it. And then I went to Northern California, where there's a so-called angel group organized by some real estate guys, and I spent an entire day listening to pitches. Not a single person organized their pitch in terms of, I'm looking to raise this amount of money at this pre-money valuation in order to do X. Everybody was just talking about fluff and values and being socially conscious. So I know New York Angels is top-notch. The other groups that I've encountered were not. So how does someone make sure they find the right group? Is there a list somewhere of the best ones?
Well, there is a list. So first of all, there is an association of angel groups called the Angel Capital Association, which is the national, effectively, trade association for angel investment groups. Their website is angelcapitalassociation.org. GUST is the platform for the ACA and most of the other federations around the world of angel investors. We actually are the official platform for the national federations of angel investment groups in 28 countries, believe it or not. So go to GUST.com, GUST.com, put in your city or region and say find investors, and you will find virtually every angel group there. So that goes to how you find them, but not necessarily to quality. You then want to do your homework. So first, one question to ask is the group a member of the Angel Capital Association? The ACA here in the U.S. has some very strict requirements. All members have to be accredited investors. The group has to have experience in actually investing in deals. They can't charge outrageous fees, all these kinds of things. On top of those as prerequisites, they actually have annual summits and quarterly sessions where the groups will share information and best practices and the like. So, ACA membership is actually a pretty good proxy for a United States group as to whether they're professional or not. And there are similar associations in Canada, and every other major developed country in the world. But the bottom line is that angel investing, as you pointed out, if you are just ready to start and write a check, okay, good, your money, but your sort of fungible money. Our mutual friend Bill, who has the, among other things, the distinction of being one of the first investors in one of the biggest unicorn success stories around. When he started investing, he didn't know what he was doing. He was a technology executive who happened to come into our group, began making investments, learned the hard way on some of these things, learned the nice way by having some home runs, and then by working and networking with other people in the group and doing his reading and doing diligence, he amassed quite a track record and then went off to start his own fund. So this is all learning, and there are sort of three ways to do it, right? And you really should do all three together. One of them is to read what's been written, and that's effectively my book. So read the book cover to cover, and you'll have a wonderful grounding in where to start. Next is join an angel group and effectively find a mentor who can help you walk through, who you can be the second, you can just tag along as they do a deal. They can explain why they structured a term sheet the way they did, or why this one seems to have value to them and not the other one. So that's really great. And then the third way, like riding a bicycle, is doing. There is no way to learn how to sail or ride a bike or scuba dive unless you actually go and do it. And that's the same thing is true for angel investing.
You mentioned GUST.com in the context of finding angel groups. Tell us a little bit more about what's there. You obviously had a lot of experience with angel groups, but you saw a need and went back to entrepreneurship so that you could launch GUST.com. What else does it do besides provide a directory of groups like New York Angels?
Well, as we've discussed, I have a background as a serial entrepreneur. So I started my first company when I was 10 years old, and I've started half a dozen companies, all the way up from high school, college, graduate school, since then, dot-com, after the dot-com world. So I have a lot of experience as a startup entrepreneur, and then I became an angel investor, and I've invested in well over 100 different companies. So I have experience as an investor. I founded New York Angels, so I have experience running an organized, group and fund of people. And then also along the way, I got involved with something called Singularity University. And Singularity U is a postgraduate program in exponential technologies, which is basically looking into the future and where all of this hyper-accelerating technology is going, and to try and predict what the world will look like then. And so Singularity University was founded by Google and NASA and Autodesk and the Kauffman Foundation and trains sort of the next generation of global leaders in how to deal with exponential technology. So I was involved with that as an associate founder. I founded their finance and entrepreneurship and economics program there. So then you add to the investing and the startup stuff, the sort of future-focused academic understanding of the future. And all of that led me to realize that the existing financial markets, as they are today, in the U.S., for example, trade 5,000 equities. So there, if you look, put it NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange, everything together, you're talking about 5,000 companies that you can buy and sell, that anybody can buy and sell because they're public stocks. On the other hand, every year in the United States, you have over 700,000 employer businesses that get started. 700,000 of these starting up businesses. So clearly, the number of these businesses that are being traded on the public markets are zero. And so that's no way to get money into these things. Instead, you're relying on individual angel investors, angel groups, and sort of haphazard way of finding these guys. And so therefore, it was apparent to me, given my background in all these different areas, that there was going to be a need, which had to be met some way, somehow, connecting all of these companies looking for funding, all these increasing people becoming angel investors, and you know, what form and shape would that take? And so that's what I set up Gust to do, to become the technical infrastructure platform for this whole world of early stage finance. And today, not only does Gust service, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs with deal room tools to reach out to investors and discuss funding, not only do we handle the back end platform and all the processes for, you know, 80% of the angel groups in the world and then provide tools to angel investors, but we do things like, you know, power the official online entrepreneurial hubs for New York City, which is called digital.nyc, or London, which is called tech.london, or Boston, which is called starthub.org in Boston. In each case, this is the official platform for the city, for its whole startup community, and that's all powered by us. So what we are doing on a long-term basis is tying all these various players together, taking all of the grunt work and the complicated stuff here and making it all easy to use, very simple and interconnected. So Gust is, if you are an angel investor, you will likely be using Gust as your tool to review pitches from companies and to collaborate with other investors and to track your investment after you make it.
Now, I don't need to ask you which book to read about angel investing, because your own book, titled Angel Investing, is, I think, pretty much the de facto hands-down winner, according to most people. It's been translated to a zillion different languages and is very widely respected as the book to read. But I do want to ask you, what would your words of wisdom be to people who are contemplating, boy, is this for me or not? Do I want to put my time and energy into learning how to do this more complicated, more involved style of investing? What should people expect? What should they watch out for? What pearls of wisdom can you share with them?
I think the two key things we've already touched on, right? One, read the book. I mean, the book lays out in great detail exactly what it's like to be an angel investor, not only how to do it, but how you got to think about what the mindset is to think about investing. And you know, if you read that book, you will pretty quickly come to a conclusion that either, you know, no, this is just too much trouble, too long haul, too risky, and not worth it. And then you won't do it, and that's great. Or you'll say, boy, it sounds sort of crazy, but it sounds exciting, and I've got a long-term horizon, and I want to, you know, be part of the future, in which case you'll do it, and it'll should work out fine. So that's, you know, number one, read the book. Number two is join an angel group, or at least go talk to an angel group. Most angel groups will invite prospective members to one or more of their breakfast or lunch or dinner sessions to meet other members and see what it's like. And so that's a great way to, without writing a check, to hear pitches in the context of an investment pitch that other people are writing checks for. It gives you the context of the larger world out there. And it gives you some idea of what these crazy entrepreneurs are like. And based on that, knowing these two things, if you then decide to take your hand at it, then you'll be in good shape. So my advice is read the book and go visit an angel group.
Okay. In closing, we have already emailed our registered users at macrovoices.com links to your TED Talk, which is about pitching a company to VCs, also the Amazon page for your book, Angel Investing, and I think we've also got a link to the Gust.com homepage. That's all in our Research Roundup email that was already mailed to registered users at macrovoices.com. For anyone listening who's not a registered user, though, is Gust.com the best place to go to follow your work? Is there anything else that you'd like to mention?
Sure. So, well, Gust is a platform. So if you're an event investor, you want to sign up on Gust or join a group, and they will sign up because we power all these groups. But you know, I would encourage people to follow me. I'm a very prolific writer on a website called Quora, Q-U-O-R-A, which is a question and answer website. And basically, I answer a whole lot of questions there, and when last seen, about 5,000 of them, on how to be an angel investor and how angels and entrepreneurs interact. So that's a good place to go. So if you want to follow me personally, I am at David S. Rose. That's the @ DavidSrose on Twitter and LinkedIn and other places. And for more information about me and the books and everything else, my own website is davidsrose.com.
Well, David, thank you so much for giving us a fantastic interview today. I really appreciate it. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
So, Eric, that was a great interview with David Rose, but something's just not adding up for me here. You told me off the air that the one and only angel deal you invested in was a 17-bagger, and you invested $50,000 in 2007 and got back $850,000 in 2016. That sounds like an unbelievable IRR of 34% annually over a 9-year period. But you've also said that your experience with that investment taught you that angel investing just wasn't for you. Dude, I must be missing something big here, because that's a fantastic rate of return. And as a retired entrepreneur, I think you'd be really, really good at angel investing. So what's the story here? Like, why didn't you continue with the angel deals after that one?
Well, you're right that I did discover that angel investing was not for me, and I agree that it's instructive for us to talk about the reasons why not on this show, as it may help others to gauge whether it's a fit for them. But I don't want to start there. I really want to focus on the positive side. As you said, my one angel deal was profoundly lucrative. For the people I've met that angel investing is a fit for, it's a fantastic fit. And so, you know, this interview with David Rose could literally be a pivotal moment for some of our listeners, especially retired entrepreneurs who are trying to decide after they've come into wealth what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. My friend Bill was in that situation. He retired from being a very successful executive in a technology company. And ever since then, he's been an angel investor, and he's described to me how it is the most personally rewarding thing that he's ever done, not just because he's been very successful financially, and the kinds of deals that you just described are not at all unheard of, but for a lot of other reasons that have nothing to do with the money. David Rose talked about some of those. One of the things I would say that I observed about it, you know, you've heard me talk for our regular listeners who listen to part one of our Accredited Investor Academy. You know that the culture of Wall Street is not necessarily my favorite place. Well, the crowd that gets involved in angel investing is mostly retired entrepreneurs. It's an entrepreneur culture. It's not Larry's culture, if you remember Larry from part one of AIA. So I think that for people who do fit the mold of angel investing, it is a profound opportunity, and I want to portray it in that light.
Okay, duly noted. Angel investing can be profoundly rewarding for those investors who are well-suited to it, but your own experience with it was profoundly profitable, and you told me off the air that your opinion is that the entrepreneur you invested in is a really good guy. And you said your opinion is that he did a fantastic job at building his company and negotiating a very successful exit, which was an acquisition by Google. That's excellent. Yet somehow you still seem to never want to have anything to do with angel investing ever again. That seems kind of crazy to me. You know, what am I missing here?
Well, there are several reasons that angel investing wasn't a match for me personally. Part of it was that I had some expectations and some ideas about what it was going to involve and why I would be good at it, and those turned out not to be what angel investing really is. So I had some misset expectations. But the main reason is going back to what I call the Schwager Doctrine, which is you have to find what style of investing meets your own personality. And there were a number of aspects of angel investing where what's required of the angel investor, it just wasn't a match for my personality. Again, those have to do with my personality defects, not with angel investing being a bad idea.
Okay, then let's start with where your expectations were out of line with what's actually involved in angel investing. How is it different than you expected?
Well, the whole reason that I was so sure that I would be so good at angel investing is that I have a long history in my career as a software technologist. I'm really, really good at very, very quickly coming up to speed on a new idea, listening to someone's idea, and knowing, number one, is it a good idea or not? But number two, being able to gauge the software engineering talent of a team. I can meet a team of software engineers, and I very quickly get an intuitive sense of whether or not they really are the ace engineers that are going to knock it out of the park, or if they're kind of second-rate programmers that don't know what they're doing. I have a really, really good track record at very quickly gauging those things. So go back to what David said. It's not about that. It's not about picking who's got the best business idea. It's about gauging the suitability of the entrepreneur, not to being a good programmer, but to running a successful business and growing it and negotiating a successful exit. So if you think back to that analogy of betting on the jockey, not the horse, I was a guy with a brilliant track record at taking the horse's temperature, gauging whether or not the horse was healthy, when in reality, it's the jockey that you need to focus on. So the assumptions I was making about why I was going to be such a good angel investor turned out not to pan out. And, you know, it's interesting, it's kind of ironic, actually, that what I invested in, the idea that I invested in, the angel deal that I made, it never happened. What happened was the guy ended up taking the money and doing something else with it. It wasn't the idea that was pitched to me. Well, that sounds probably like a criticism, like the entrepreneur did some kind of bait and switch. Not true at all. He set out in good faith to do exactly what he had pitched to us. The environment in, you know, remember this deal was in 2007. A lot of things changed in 2008 and 2009. By the time he got into it, the environment had changed, and it made more sense for him to shift gears and do something else and take his company in a different direction than the specific idea that had been pitched to me. So suddenly, what I had evaluated as a really brilliant technical idea was no longer even relevant. The company was off doing something else, and I didn't even know what they were doing. Frankly, being a good angel investor requires a whole lot of patience, and I have to admit that that's just not my strong suit. The way that these angel groups vet their deals, the way it works is you don't just get to go pitch an idea to an angel group. You have to have one of the angels in that group sponsor you. So you've got to first persuade one of the members that you've got an idea that's worth investing in. That person can then sponsor you and get you an opportunity to make a 15-minute pitch to the entire angel group. And it's kind of ironic that the entrepreneurs are usually very frustrated that they feel like 15 minutes is just an unfairly short amount of time. Frankly, in my experience with it, which was only attending a few of these meetings, I could tell in 15 seconds that what was being pitched was an utterly lame idea that was going nowhere. It takes a whole lot of sitting around all day through pitch after pitch after pitch. Every one of these entrepreneurs thinks that he's got the crown jewel of ideas. They believe in themselves, as they should. You want them to. But a lot of them have what, frankly, are a bunch of dumb ideas that they think are the greatest thing ever. And they often get personally indignant if you're not supportive of them because they believe so strongly in whatever it is. And frankly, a lot of the ideas you've heard three or four times before from somebody with the same idea. And all of them think it's unique and they're the only one that's had it. They're all afraid that you're going to steal it from them and so forth. So it requires a whole lot of patience, and frankly, that's not my strong suit.
Right. So before we move on to the Schwager Doctrine, as you mentioned, with those issues of how angel investing is suited for your personality, do you have anything else to say about misplaced expectations?
Well, this next one is really a little bit of both Schwager Doctrine and misplaced expectations. Angel investors are typically older and a whole lot more experienced in business than the entrepreneurs who are seeking funding. That leads a lot of angel investors, who themselves are retired entrepreneurs, to unrealistic expectations about what the angel-entrepreneur relationship is going to be like. Quite frankly, what happened to me and what I've seen happen to a lot of other people is your ego gets involved. And so you imagine yourself being looked up to as the business guru, the oracle of wisdom and experience, the father figure and business coach who the young entrepreneur is going to look up to as a mentor as he grows and develops his company. Look, that feels good, but it's not reality. The entrepreneur who's starting out and looking for funding is much more likely to view angels as a necessary evil. He already believes in himself. He's absolutely convinced that he knows what to do in order to make his company successful. He has no interest in looking up to some old guy for advice that he doesn't think he needs. Usually, he's going to feel that the angel's financial return expectations are outright exploitive. And it shouldn't surprise anyone that they feel that way, because put yourself in their shoes. Now, remember what David Rose said in the interview. You can expect, if you do it right, on your overall balanced portfolio of angel investments to make about a 25% IRR. But at least half of the deals are failures, 100% loss. Well, the only way you can have a 25% IRR if half of the deals are 100% loss is the other half have to be returning really fantastic returns. So you've got to aim for making 50% annually on the deal, or it's not worth doing. When the entrepreneur figures out that you expect to make a 50% per year return on your investment in his company, remember his perspective. He believes in himself, and because he believes in himself, he doesn't see that risk of 100% loss. He's absolutely convinced that he can do it. So he thinks the risk is much, much lower. The almost inevitable result is that the entrepreneur thinks he's getting screwed. He thinks that, unfortunately, he has to tolerate these greedy SOB angels who expect ridiculous rates of return, and he wish he didn't have to deal with those sons of bitches at all, but he has to because he needs the money in order to get the company launched. And it's hard to blame them for feeling that way. I felt the same way when I was an entrepreneur. I bootstrapped all of my businesses. I didn't take any venture capital or angel money because I thought those guys were too greedy. So it's no surprise that that's the way most entrepreneurs feel. If you have expectations that they're going to look up at you and treasure you as the oracle of wisdom and advice, it's not going to happen. That's just not what these deals tend to be like. Now, as far as entrepreneurs wanting advice from their angels, there is definitely truth to that, but it's in a very specific category. It's when they want more money. One of the most important things in the repertoire of a successful angel investor is a network, a good Rolodex of contacts in the venture capital business, so that when your entrepreneur gets to the point where now he doesn't need a couple $100,000 that you could raise with your other angels, but he needs a couple $3 million to take his business to the next level, the entrepreneur is very much going to want your help in finding who's going to give him the rest of the money. So having that network of access to venture capitalists is important. Similarly, when it's time for an exit, when it's time to look for what company is going to acquire the company that you invested in, or when the company that you invested in is ready to go public, if you have the investment banking connections to hook them up with the right people to help those things happen, they want your help there. But as far as how to run the company, they don't want help from an angel investor in that regard. So I would actually invoke an analogy to parenting here. A lot of people that I know who are parents have told me that it is the single most rewarding thing that they've ever done. And similarly, I have met angel investors like my friend Bill who tell me that it is the most rewarding thing they've ever done in business, better than running the company that they ran as an entrepreneur. It's the most rewarding thing ever. That may be true, but just like parenting, it doesn't mean that you're not going to deal with puberty and rebellious teenagers along the way. And you've got to have the patience and willingness to deal with entrepreneurs who will often resent you for helping them in ways that they don't fully appreciate until much later.
Sounds like an apt analogy. So let's move on to some of the other ways in which angel investing wasn't a match for your personality. Eric, what didn't work for you specifically?
Well, frankly, I'm used to being in charge of things. I've never had a real job. I've run my own companies for my entire life, and I'm very flattered to have received some positive accolades for that. I've had employees tell me I was the best boss they ever had, and that really, really feels good. But frankly, I don't have any real experience playing on someone else's team. As an angel, it's not your business. It's the entrepreneur's business. Not only was I not the team captain, I'm not even on the team. I'm not the CEO. I'm not even a partner. I'm not even an employee. I'm just some guy who put up, in the grand scheme of things, a very small amount of money, as did a whole bunch of other guys. The relationship that I had with the entrepreneur that I invested in was Eric Townsend. That name rings a bell. Oh, wait a minute. I think he's one of the angels that invested in my company. I'll have to look. I'm not sure. You know, that's as much as the guy knows about me, and it's as much as he should be expected to know about me. I'm not used to shutting up and minding my own business. I'm a control freak. It's not my strong suit. So David writes in his book about one of the things you've got to be ready for is you can't freak out if you lose 100% when you invest in a company that does everything right. They're getting ready to launch their killer product. It's going to be so awesome. And a week before the launch, Google does the exact same thing and gives it away for free. And suddenly the company has no prospects. Well, believe it or not, that wouldn't bother me much. I could deal with that risk. But what I learned is I could not live with watching an entrepreneur make stupid mistakes that I would never make and then not listen to me when I'm trying to help get him back on the right path. Now, that didn't even happen. The guy that I invested in did a flawless job. But he did it his way, and part of his way was playing things pretty close to his chest. I didn't see what his business strategy is. I didn't know how he was changing his plans, nor was it any of my business. But as a control freak, it was very difficult for me to go through that. So the fact it didn't match for me was very much because I have a very controlling personality. I'm used to being the CEO. This guy was doing it not my way, but his way. Well, who the hell does he think he is, the CEO? Oh, yeah, he is the CEO. I'm nobody. He's doing the right thing.
Yeah. So I guess to summarize, angel investing is not for people who need to feel in control of everything all the time. So if you're a control freak, basically, it's for people who are willing and able to believe in someone else's talent and then to allow the entrepreneur the freedom and latitude to run their business their way. And you're basically admitting that although you now think the entrepreneur you invested in did a great job, at the time you found it frustrating and maybe even a little difficult to see him doing things his way and not your way.
Well, to be clear, I knew he was doing a good job all along. I saw the company growing, and I knew that he was doing a great job. But I didn't know all the details, and I wanted to know. I wanted to see the financial statements. Well, angels don't have reporting rights necessarily. The financial statements were none of my business. I didn't get to see the plans, you know, before they were announced to the public for what idea he was going to do instead of the one that they originally pitched to me, because that's competitive information that's none of my business. I'm not in the company. I imagined what it would be like if he was screwing up, even though he wasn't, and this investment of only $50,000 became a source of frustration for me. I was just, you know, it was just the imagined fantasy of him screwing up, even though I actually knew he wasn't screwing up, that was driving me crazy. So what I did several years ago, because I had to, was I mentally wrote off this investment as 100% loss. Not because I had any reason to think the company was not doing well, but you know, I'm making or losing $50,000 in an afternoon on a trade. And you know, I know what's going on and I'm very comfortable with it. I take those losses. It's just part of doing business. The $50,000 that I can't see the details of was driving me crazy. So to protect my sanity, I wrote it off as a total loss and forgot about it years ago. Then just a few weeks ago, actually, in the spring of 2016, I get an email saying, "We urgently need your bank wiring instructions. We've got a strategic acquisitions closing tomorrow." Of course, I didn't have any advance notice of it. I wasn't entitled to any advance notice of it. I owned 0.63% of this company. I was a tiny little player. So I made out very well. I got very lucky that this deal happened to be a home run. But frankly, had it gone the other way, it still would have been a worthwhile investment. The $50K that I invested, if that had gone to zero, which was the more likely outcome, I would have learned that angel investing was not for me. And the way that I got into this was knowing I was going to make one investment and see how it worked. I learned it wasn't for me. I probably should have lost the $50K, and that should have been the price of my lesson. And it turns out I got lucky and made $850K on the deal.
Well, what are the other aspects of angel investing that didn't match your investor personality, Eric?
They mainly center on liquidity and agility. again, you've got to find the style of investing that suits your personality. I'm a very agile guy. You know, if you're going to be in an angel investment that lasts 10 years, the macro backdrop is guaranteed to change over the course of that decade. I'm very good at looking at changing circumstances and saying, boy, the reason I got into this investment didn't pan out. The macro environment has changed. It makes sense to just eat my losses and walk away from this and move on to a better opportunity. I'm pretty good at that style of being an agile investor. Angel investing is not matched to that. Angel investing is good for people who are willing to say, I'm taking this $50K, I'm not going to even find out whether it was a loss or a profit until 10 years from now, and I'll just ride it out. I'm not good at that. So the deal that I did came at the beginning of reinventing myself as a private investor, and I didn't know where else to find 25% annualized returns at that time. Well, now I do. So the place that I would disagree slightly with David Rose, he said in the beginning that you can get 25% returns in angel investing. Well, you're not going to find that in hedge funds. Well, you've got to remember that most hedge funds are designed not to do that. They're designed for very low volatility because what's going on in the hedge fund world right now is a lot of institutional investors are looking for a very low volatility replacement for bonds in their portfolios. So those kinds of hedge funds are not going to do that, but the kinds of hedge funds that take anything close to the kind of risk that's involved in angel investing most assuredly do produce those kinds of returns. So I've learned how in my own trading, and I've also learned more about other types of alternative investments that are available, to know that it's not the only place that you can find 25% plus annual returns, and I know that there are other places where the style of investing is more conducive to my personality, particularly for me, it's about autonomy. In order to produce those big returns takes work. For the angel investor, it means investing lots of time and energy in vetting deals, getting to know entrepreneurs, figuring out who really has a good idea that's worth investing in, and making the right investments. That work is with other people, and frankly, it is with less experienced people. If you've got that parenting gene where you want to be working with young entrepreneurs and tolerating the fact that they get very emotional and don't understand how much they don't know, and you can eventually, like a parent, get them through puberty and high school to the point where they become grown-ups someday, and that's rewarding to you, great. Frankly, what's much happier for me is to be autonomous. The way that I look to make high returns is to try to find inefficiencies in markets, and I do that by analyzing data. It is admittedly very isolating. It doesn't involve working with a lot of other human beings. It's a lot of time spent by myself in front of a whole bunch of computer screens, but it's something where I don't have to deal with what to me are, you know, the businessman's equivalent to watching a lot of kids go through puberty and high school, which is what I feel like angel investing can be for some of the investors that I've known that are very experienced with it.
Interesting, the parent analogy. I guess there is autonomy, but there's no liquidity. I mean, as of right now, I'm not aware of any free markets for children. But you've mentioned several times now that you've encountered frustration dealing with newbie entrepreneurs who didn't really seem to even know how much they didn't know. So, Eric, can you elaborate with some specific examples of what you're talking about when it comes to meeting new entrepreneurs as an angel investor?
Sure. I want to be clear up front. I'm not talking about the guy that I invested with. I picked him in part because he was different from the crowd. But when you meet entrepreneurs, first-time entrepreneurs, usually they'll show up at the first meeting, and with no prior disclosure that this is their intention, they'll pull out a non-disclosure agreement and expect you to sign it. And so you sit there and say, okay, where do I start with this guy? Do I explain to him that no angel investor in their right mind ever signs non-disclosure agreements? Do I explain to him that it's frankly kind of immature on his part to be showing up with that expectation at a meeting, not having disclosed it to me in an email ahead of time? No, that's just asking for trouble. Let me focus on how to be positive with this guy. Let's focus on another topic, which maybe I can get through to him on, which is, dude, there's no reason to have a non-disclosure agreement because I don't need to hear all about your idea. Usually they think that they've got the secret sauce and their idea is just the greatest thing since sliced bread. As David Rose emphasized in this interview, that's not the most important thing. What's the most important thing is that individual, their suitability to being a successful entrepreneur. That's what I need to gauge, and I don't need to hear what the business plan is in order to do that. So I focus on that because I know that explaining to him that thinking any angel is going to sign an NDA was ignorant on his part. That's just, you know, asking for trouble. So it's quickly evidence that he knows absolutely nothing about the capital formation process and hasn't done any of his homework. I had one guy come to me with a table of mortgage rates, and he said, look, these are what the mortgages are going for. This is what the banks are lending at for mortgages. This one's 4%. This one's 6%. The average of all of these is 5.03%. I'm willing to double it. I'm willing to give you 10% for a loan. And so, okay. The guy doesn't even understand the difference between debt financing and equity financing. He thinks he can get equity financing, which is unavailable to him at the stage that he's at any interest rate. How do I explain this to him in a way that doesn't hurt his feelings, that doesn't make him get paranoid that I'm trying to take advantage of him? How do I get him through this knothole and explain to him how the capital formation process actually works, explain how equity financing works, get him to understand that he needs to think in terms of not interest rates of borrowing, but what he needs to focus on is something that they call the pre-money valuation, which is what his company is worth before the money comes in, and that effectively is determining the cost of financing. These are all things that he should have known had he done his homework before he ever came to a first meeting with an angel investor, but they never seem to. It's very likely if you get past all that and you want to actually fund the guy and you've invested in him, he's going to be very much involved. You know, if he's making widgets, he's going to be focused on the widget business and knowing his market and his customers and so forth. Interestingly enough, when it comes to being an entrepreneur, it's more important to understand the much bigger picture of not what's going on in your industry, but rather what are financial entities paying to buy companies like yours. Are we in an environment, as we sometimes have, where there's too much money chasing not a lot of good deals and there are really excessive valuations like we had in the late 90s when I sold my company? Or are we in a period where a lot of liquidity has dried up and it's very hard to find an acquirer because public companies are not acquisitive due to who knows what's going on in the economy? That's the cycle that you really have to have your eye on. They're generally not looking at it, and it's very hard to get through to them to get them to understand the importance of it. Another example is, when is it time for them to move on beyond their angel round and raise a much larger amount of money from a venture capitalist? Well, when the venture capitalists have too much money chasing not enough good deals and you can get a really good valuation for your company, that's the best time to do it. He's not going to be thinking that way. He's going to be thinking about when he needs money, and he's going to resist you when you try to give him advice and say, look, valuations are really high right now. Even though you might not need this money for 6 months or a year, liquidity is going to dry up. This is the right time. If it's unasked for advice, he's probably not going to listen to you.
Okay, I wanted to make sure we got all the reasons that angel investing was not a fit for you personally, because I think your experience may be instructive in helping other accredited investors evaluate whether it's a match for them personally. But now that we have that out of the way, Eric, what's your advice to accredited investors who are still interested in maybe considering angel investing for themselves?
Well, first and foremost, don't let me get you down. Everything that I said about why it was not a fit for me, it didn't match my personality. The people that I know that do this have an absolute blast doing it. The networks of friendships that are developed among experienced angel investors are really powerful. It's amazing stuff. The first step for sure is read David's book cover to cover at least once. Second step, find a really good angel group and attend some of their meetings. Listen to some pitches. See how it feels to sit and listen to pitches from entrepreneurs all day. If you're in New York City, I cannot strongly enough recommend David's own group, New York Angels. But if you're someplace else, frankly, my experience was not all angel groups are created equal. So David gave you some good advice on how to find a good one. Be sure to find a good one. If you've been to a few of these meetings and you still feel that this is for you, I would recommend following the plan that I used. And although David did say in the interview that I was doing it wrong by only doing one angel deal, I think he would actually agree with me if he understood the full context of that. The decision that I made was, you're not going to know about this until you've tried it. So I said, I'm going to put, you know, pick an amount of money that I can afford to lose completely, 100%, if it turns out not to be right, and do one and only one angel deal, just for the sake of getting my feet wet, and spend at least a year making sure it's really a match for me before I do any others. And I think that's very good advice. I'm pretty sure David would agree with that. What I did was bet the jockey, not the horse, for sure, but it wasn't just the entrepreneur who I was very impressed with. I had become very impressed with my friend Bill, who I'd met at a couple of these New York Angels meetings. When I was already impressed with Bill as an angel investor and as a businessman, we'd had a number of conversations. I really liked and respected this guy. And then after listening to a whole bunch of pitches from entrepreneurs who had what I thought were pretty lame ideas, the guy that Bill was sponsoring in the meeting gets up, and he was the guy I invested with, partly because he very much impressed me of having a brilliant idea and excellent technology infrastructure and plans for what he was going to do, but in at least equal part, if not greater part, because it was Bill's deal, and I wanted to do a deal with Bill as the lead investor. Over the next year, I learned a whole lot about angel investing from Bill. We became good friends, and I learned that angel investing was not for me. Bill, on the other hand, has gone on. He was just profoundly successful at angel investing, and eventually went on to launch his own venture capital fund. He actually asked me not to publicize his name, because unfortunately, if you're thinking, Eric got in on one of Bill's deals, I should do the same. Please do not email me asking for an introduction to Bill. He went out of his way to tell me he doesn't want to be introduced to angels. He's moved on. He's not co-investing with other angels. He's managing a venture fund that does early stage deals now. So unfortunately, Bill is not your mentor, but you need to find one. Having him in my life was extremely valuable to me. In hindsight, my $50,000 investment was probably too high, given that my goal was just to try it once. Now, of course, with perfect hindsight, knowing how it was going to pan out, I wish I had invested $5 million, not $50,000. But, there was no way of knowing that in the beginning. Since the most likely outcome was 100% loss and never doing another angel deal again, that $50,000 would have been the price of learning that angel investing was not for me. $25,000 probably would have been a more comfortable number. Needless to say, I have no regrets that I overspent at $50,000 because I made $800,000 out of the deal.
Well, Eric, I've got a lot more questions for you related to angel investing, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close?
Nothing else on angel investing, Aaron, but I do want to thank everybody that's helped us. We booked Gary Schilling thanks to a referral from a listener, so we've got Gary coming up in August. We've got a fantastic set of guests coming up, and we will be returning to our usual focus of macroeconomics. We brought you a couple of interviews, Eric Hunsader and, of course, David Rose this week, being a little bit off our usual format. We're going to get back to the macro focus starting next week, and we've got a bunch of really exciting guests coming up. Please register at macrovoices.com, especially you accredited investors. That helps us recruit hedge fund managers and other high-profile guests that you want us to get on the program. You'll also get our research roundup as a benefit of registering. We're running out of time, Aaron, but very quickly, what is in this week's research roundup?
Yeah, to be brief, since we're nearly out of time, it's another fully loaded newsletter, and we obviously can't highlight all the great content, but we've got the latest investor letters from hedge fund giants Dan Loeb and David Einhorn. Also, I want to draw your attention to Dr. Ben Hunt's latest entry in his popular Epsilon Theory blog that discusses crisis actors and compares the current Turkish coup, or attempted coup, to the Reichstag fire in 1933. It's a great article, and I think it's a must-read, especially for those of you who enjoy history. And finally, we have former Swedish hedge fund manager Mikael Siding. He's back with an article detailing his trading tactics, and I think you'll greatly enjoy that article. So that does it for us for this week's edition. Thanks again to everyone for the suggestions, retweets, and follows. I'm happy to announce that Macro Voices has reached the 1,000 follower milestone, all thanks to your help. We definitely want to reach more people so that we can get in front of and recruit the top-notch guests that everyone wants. The best way you can help us is by engaging with us on Twitter, continue sending us your suggestions and feedback, and to share Macro Voices with your friends, colleagues, and family members. Again, I encourage our listeners who blog or write about macro or trading, feel free to drop us a line with your article by emailing us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter. You can follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend or myself at @_AaronChan_ for the latest news on Macro Voices or general market commentary. Also, don't forget to follow our main account at Macro Voices. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.